Hello and welcome to Real Talk. It's Tuesday at lunchtime. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. You're listening to the voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. Real Talk is the show that is here every Tuesday to answer questions large and small. Today our question is, what's it like to be in jail and what is it like to come out? The gentleman who is going to help us understand that, we hope, is Threat Brown. He's my guest today. He's executive director of Young Businessmen and Women in Tacoma and one of the founders of Numbers to Names, a group of folks that help people come out of jail and stay out. Welcome, Threat.
I appreciate you all the time.
Thank you so much for being here. Mm-hmm. This isn't the first time you've been to Voice of Vashon.
No, it's not. And I love it every single time.
And we love you.
Yes, indeed.
The question today is, what is it like to be in jail? And you've been there.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us? How can you help us understand what it really feels like to have your freedom taken away?
Mm-hmm. One of the most crucial parts is understanding, like it's a lot of times it's a complete difference. So you got jail, you have prison, and then you have work camps. So the difference in jail is that jail is just a waiting period until you're sent up into the institution or your mother institution. So prison is a totally different situation than what jail is. A lot of the times when you're in the county, people rather go to prison because the steel time in the county is like a little... The steel time in county is too steel. It's like maximum security. You spend most of your time no movement at all, you know, with an exception of coming out of your cell and sitting in a dorm area, then going back into your bunks or whatnot. But when you get to prison, you got more movement. It depends on what position in prison that you are, because you got closed custody, maximum security. You got medium custody, which you got a little more freedom to move around. The problem with prison, or either or, is that why are you in there a lot of the time? Some of the times you got a lot of people that's incarcerated for false charges, you know? So for those people, my heart goes out to them tremendously, you know, because it's not a place to be, you know, especially when you know you haven't committed a crime. And so when you're there, you miss out a lot of things. It's the things that happens outside of prison that affects people the most once you're incarcerated. So, you know, you can sit in prison all day, really, and do your time. And if you got something to structure, if you got a plan to put together, then you got all the time in the world to structure that plan or write that book or do a movie script or get your body in shape. So it's a lot of benefits to people that are being incarcerated. But it's what happens outside. Like, most suicide rates occur heavily in prison when holidays have come about, you know, so you can't be with your friends, your families, or birthdays and holidays and things like that. So that's the most emotional disconnect with being incarcerated, you know.
You mentioned that a lot of folks in prison are there for crimes they did not commit. How does that happen?
Wrong place at the wrong time, not paying attention to your surrounding. What ended me incarceration, because I was supportive of a friend of mine. You know, I was familiar with the crime that he was committing. It was a drug charge. So I noticed that he was selling drugs, you know, but I just refused to call the police and tell the police that my friend's outside selling drugs in front of my house. And so the whole time he was being recorded, because they was doing an indictment and working a sting in the area they call Chaka City in Tacoma, or the Lakewood area. And so when they incarcerated me, I was guilty by association. My actual charge was an accomplice to an illegal drug transaction and possession with an intent to deliver. The sad fact is that I wasn't in possession of a controlled substance, nor did I deliver a controlled substance. So for me to end up in prison behind somebody else's actions, then I got to blame myself too, for the most part, because I should have known better. I should have knew that if I'm not selling drugs, then don't be surrounding myself with people that are in that lifestyle, because it catches you up in a whole bunch of situations. But that happens with murders and stuff too. I don't have to commit a murder. I could just be with somebody that committed a murder. And if they don't release me from the fact to say that, well, Threat didn't know I was going to kill somebody. But most people ain't going to do that when they know they're looking at football numbers, which is double digits. When you got people that's going to do like real time, they're not trying to say that it was just me. You know, a lot of the times they're going to be like, well, just walk it out with me and don't be a rat and don't be a snitch and all of those things. And it's like, come on now, something's got to give. And so, so that's what I mean by incarcerated for false charges.
So it's basically guilt by association.
Yes, very much.
And is there some legal precedent for that? I can understand that in the case of a murder, in fact, if you were a witness, mm-hmm. if you don't say anything about it, mm-hmm. you do have responsibility. Mm-hmm. Is the same principle applied to a drug deal?
same principle. Yeah, it's applied to the same concept because they're all crimes. They're all considered to be crimes, you know. So it's mindful of the person. I have to be mindful of who my company is, you know. I have to be mindful of my circle. And if I'm familiar with what these people do, then I can't look at the fact that I'm a part of something that I'm wrongfully accused of. So it's a double-edged sword at the end of the day, because you don't know, like, when your friend's going to do something a lot of the times, but you're with him. So now you're in this ruffle situation, and you got this thing like G-code, and the G-code says street code is that you can't rat, and you got to walk out the process of everybody else. And it's like, well, where do the line draw, and where is it drawn in this situation? Because me being me, if I commit a crime and you wasn't the participant in the crime that I committed, I will release you from that situation. But in real life, a lot of people don't do that. Nobody want to do 40 years by themselves if you was in the car with them or if you was surrounded with them. So I have to know. I guess it goes back to knowing your company.
So you're at risk on both sides of that wall.
Very much.
You're at risk among your associates if you rat on them.
Mm-hmm. Very much.
And if you don't rat on them, the law is going to put you at risk and put you in jail.
Yeah.
So you wound up in jail. Mm-hmm. Did you wind up in jail? Where exactly did you wind up?
Well, I went to jail. Then I was sent to prison. I see the thing with me as that. As a kid, I always wanted to go to prison since I was like 8, like I said, a lot of times.
Tell us about that.
So I had no father figure. So my dad passed away when I was 6 years old. He died in a car accident. And so the only other male influence that I did have was two of my uncles, John Brown and William Brown. John Brown was, I believe, sentenced to like 27 years. He got shot like 15 times by the police, and then he had to do a 27-year stint in New Orleans, Louisiana. And so I used to see some of the items and stuff that he sent home to my mom that he made in prison. I thought that was the coolest thing ever. And so I felt that, through the influence of me talking to him every once in a while over the phone and getting a letter, that is, for whatever crazy reason, it inspired me to want to be like my uncles. And then my other uncle, William Brown, he was off and on in prison for like 17 to 19 years. And so that was my motivation. And so I sought out early to go to prison. And so when I ended up in there, I realized my first year, I was like, I'm not trying to be up in here, right?
This is not fun.
This is not the truth at all. And so, me going in, and when I was inside, they put me in a work camp, and I felt that the work camp was too petty. It was childish. It wasn't aggressive enough, because I'm on the streets. I'm running with a reckless group of people. Mm-hmm. So my whole surrounding was extreme. And so for me to be in here at a kiddie school, which they consider a work camp, as kiddie school is minimum security. And so I started committing, you know, crime in the institution, like kicking holes in the walls and things of that nature.
How old were you at this time?
21. And so I got sent up real fast. And so I went to Sheldon, McNeil Island. I was in Column Bay. I was in Cedar Creek, Pine Lodge, OCC. So they moved me around a lot. So they really gave me a real tour of what the prison system was like. I never closed out, you know, but I was close enough in medium security in Column Bay for me to get a good understanding of what I don't want to do for the rest of my life.
What do you mean by closed out?
Closed custody is where you got people that's locked up for violent, extreme violent crimes.
Oh.
And so they go maximum security, and closed custody is like a 23-hour lockdown. You literally get your hour out. I mean, with all of them is the same way, but when you go behind the walls, you literally locked in your cell all day. But when you're in medium security, you got flow through the day room. So you can come out of your cell, go back in your cell, watch TV, sit out there, play cards. But in closed custody, you don't have access to do none of that. You in one cell, if two. But I don't think they do two cells because of the crime that people commit. You know, they keep them separated.
So how long were you in prison?
4 years.
4 years.
Yeah.
What did you do at that time?
I reflect that I lost a lot. You know, I lost my best friend without prison. And that's what really changed me. When my closest friend, you know, he got murdered on the streets. And then so when that happened, I had to make some adjustments within myself. And then I spoke with a friend of mine, shout out to Sammy Long. That's a close friend of mine. And so Sammy Long was the gentleman, because I had to go around. I told people I wasn't interested in living this life, you know what I'm saying, this type of lifestyle with this gangster stuff, you know. So it's in me all the time, you know. And just to be frank, you know, it's a part of my genetics, because that's how I'm cut that way. But I got to learn how to harness myself and keep my aggression extremely toned down. And I've mastered that. And so when I spoke to him as a representative of the community that we come from, he was like, well, Threat, I respect you as a man to handle your business. And so from that point on, I decided to do better. And I started writing books, and I worked out a lot. And conditioned bodies condition minds. So I found that out real fast. You know, me staying actively involved. And I learned a lot. I listened a lot. I was educated by a lot of sharp people that you'll never, ever see on the face of this planet, ever. You know, and so that in itself is powerful.
Who were those people that helped you?
Oh, man. It's Juice, Citrus, Uncle T. Wright, you know.
Were they inmates?
Yeah, they was inmates.
So
yeah.
It was the inmates who were helping you. What sort of help or offers of help did you get from the institution itself or from social workers who came in there? Anybody?
Yeah, I never understood about social workers. Counselors was all over the place. But the thing that I did get, which is sad and I don't encourage, but what I have being from an African-American male from a community broken, I gained structure in incarcerated. So prison gave me an extreme form of structure. My bed was made up. My things was aligned. My clothes was always folded up. I was programming. I was on top of everything. I was reading every day. I was going to school. I was staying out of trouble. My dress etiquette extremely transformed. I kept my pants pulled up. I had my shirt tucked in. I carried myself. I had to read the dictionary. OGs and people that was in there for long term, they made you read the dictionary. I read the Bible front to back twice, three times in my life since I was incarcerated. So, you know, all of those things, you know, was structure, and it gave me what I needed as a young man that didn't have it on the street. So that was my appreciation of prison, because it gave me order. You know, sad to say, it gave me extreme order. And then when released from prison, you realize how much structure you had. And that's one of the main reasons why a lot of people that's from broken communities end up recommitting crimes, because they miss the structure. You know, a lot of the times they miss the structure of it's no responsibilities, actually, you know.
Yeah, let's go there. Well, first of all, I want you to describe to me what you mean by the term a broken community. What is a broken community?
Okay, so as far as broken community, single parent homes, mothers trying to raise kids on their own. A lot of the times, mothers trying to raise kids on their own when they're not even doing good themselves. So your mother's miscomplacent, or she's working 36 jobs, you know, so nobody's at the house to attend to the child. And the influence of the older males in the community are just as shot as we are as young people trying to grow up. So even the adult mentors that we did have, they wasn't structured. They didn't have order. They was looking for the same thing the average teenager was looking for. You know, they was looking for opportunities. They was looking for their own self-guidance, and in trying to guide other young people in a pattern which was broken in itself. Opportunities is work, jobs. We didn't believe in any of that.
Oh, you know, so what were the opportunities? They were
hustling, selling drugs, you know, looking for the next person to rob. If somebody got something better than you, we want to get it. Fast paced money, influenced by music videos and a lot of those things. And a lot of people like to harp away from that, but I like to jump straight on that, because if you see a child watching television, they see a music video, and this person on the music video got the clothes and they got the shoes and they got the cars and they got the women and they got the money. Now, it's one thing to see that on television, but when you can remove yourself from the television screen, walk outside, and some of your friends pull up in the cars with the jewelry, and reality of TV becomes reality in real life. So it's something that we can obtain if we live the criminalistic lifestyle. And then we don't realize until after the fact of being incarcerated that it was all fabricated and was none of it real. Because when you start to really sit down with people that's doing three consecutive life sentences, living that lifestyle, and they're educating me on what I should do different since I have a release date. A lot of the times people don't even like to see you get out. And that's why they tell you in the penitentiary to keep your release date to yourself, because it becomes almost a slap in the face for a lot of people. Don't nobody want to see you go home, really, at the end of the day, especially when they build rapport. I don't shed tears from people, you know, that I met in there that I have to leave, you know, because I can't spend the rest of my life up in here. So, and that's crucial. And so that broken community piece, and a lot of them find structure and they find family in there. You take half of the young men in the community, their uncles, their moms, their dads, everybody's in prison or they dead. So when they in the streets, they feel lonely. They feel like they out here by themselves. So it's better for them to probably go to the penitentiary and chill with their brother or chill with their cousin, only to realize it's your cousin or your brother or your dad that's up in there saying you should be out there making a difference. But you can't do that right now because you're doing 40, 50 years.
So let me ask you this. One of the things, maybe it's a myth, that those of us who are not part of that culture hear is that when people are in prison, they don't learn to live in the outside world. They learn to be better criminals. That doesn't sound like it was your experience.
No, but at the same time, when you don't have hope, when you feel like you don't have anything to come out to, because you got to take in consideration, people that are getting out, most of their family's in here. already. Most of their closest friends are in here already for the rest of their life. So they only learning how to get out and try to be a criminal more so. I was a gentleman, I can't repeat his name, but, you know, it's a gentleman that, and it shook me tremendously. You know, he was already doing a lot of time, and his only attitude was, I'm going to make sure that this time when I get out, I got enough money to buy me a TV when I come back up in here. So when I heard that, I was like, golly. So the system is real. And the system is designed in a manner to where you don't have to worry about bills and responsibilities. I start to believe a lot of the times that you got some people with so much defects, dysfunctions about themselves that they don't even want people to know. And that's a lot of the times why people be incarcerated. There's private things that we don't know about people that they're so afraid of people finding out that they feel that prison is the best place for them because it hides their secrets from reality and from people, you know? So what better place for me to be than be in prison?
Wow, it's a physical and an emotional imprisonment. You're listening to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and my guest is Threat Brown. He's one of the founders of Numbers to Names, an organization that helps people who come out of prison stay out of prison. And we can do this thanks to Windermere Vachon Real Estate for their support. They make our community information programming and our emergency alert service possible. I want to thank you all for listening. And I want to go, Threat, now to what does happen when a person comes out of prison. Yeah.
Man, I got out in 2004. I had to get out of the city of Tacoma. The reason why I had to get out of the city of Tacoma because I had too many negative influences that I was familiar with. It was so much stuff that happened to my family when I was incarcerated and my best friend more so than anything that I had an issue with people. You know, I had an agenda to seek out people. I wanted to find certain people.
Revenge.
And yeah, very much so. And then the thing that prevented me from seeking revenge is that when I got out, a lot of people was like, Threat, we heard you want to do this and we want to do that. And I was like, oh, so if that many people knowing exactly what my intentions was, then if I commit this intention, then it all pointed the fingers back at me. And so I was blessed enough to pay attention to the signs of pink fingers being pointed back at me that I resisted the urge to feel like I had to accomplish something to get some correction about people.
That's a pretty vulnerable position.
Yeah, very much. And so being out, I didn't know about reentry. I didn't know about any of that. I didn't have nobody coaching me. I didn't have nobody walking me to a building to get some better assistance, driver license, and any of that, you know, so I had to figure it out. And so as I realize it now, I started to notice that a lot of people that get out, a lot of them do not know about the opportunity that's really out here because a lot of people get out of prison, they feel like it's the end of the world. Because sometimes it is the end of the world if they don't want to apply themselves, which is why I'm in a position to do the things that I do, because I want to be a entrance that when people do are released from prison, you know, they have somebody at least that they can relate to.
So outline for our listeners what it is that makes it feel like the end of the world. What specifically does a person formerly incarcerated face or lose when they come out of prison?
If you start looking at the fact of an ID card, even if you can't get an ID card, that is so, so much. That's hectic. The bus system is totally different. You have people, again, it goes right back to broken families or families that don't even want you because of your circumstances, your predicament. A lot of felons can't even go to their houses because some families don't Section 8, things of that nature. So no felons is allowed in the house. Housing is a critical thing. The record that you got, it prevents you from getting work unless you're working at a Jack in the Box or a Taco Bell. And then it becomes the pride of a lot of people that don't want to see themselves in a situation like working at a fast food restaurant that leads them to going back to the streets. And so when you have no transportation, for one, you're released from prison with not enough finances to establish yourself. Now, if you was released from prison and you had enough money to get you an apartment for at least up to 6 months and you had enough money to get you a piece of transportation to get you around and you had a steady little work gig, then that can be a lot more beneficial than a person just being thrown out. When I was put out of prison, I was just saying, OK, boom, now you get to go out here and do your thing. And from there, it was like, OK, so what do I do? If it wasn't for, you know, I stayed at my mother's house for like 2 weeks when I was released. And in those 2 weeks, you know, I got complacent. I ended up resorting back to old habits. My first 3 months out, I started trying to come up like I normally do, because a lot of the times the community, the people don't feel like work is their thing. You know, and it's sad, you know, because it's a self-inflicted concept. It's a self-perception of things. It's a cultural perspective of things. We feel that the only way to do things is to hustle.
So only bozos work.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's cornballs up in there doing a 9-to-5 and punching the clock, you know. Yeah. So what better for me to do is just to get out here and get it how we live is what they say. You know, you got to get it how you live. And I'm like, nah, there's another opportunity for you to get it, you know, but those are the things. No funding, no job, no actual no ground support is what's really lacking. If they had a sponsor when they got out, somebody to say, I'll take you under my wing and provide you with the actual resources. Like we got programs like a pre-apprenticeship or the apprenticeship program. A lot of those are 6-month programs. And a lot of people can't sustain themselves or get stability long enough to even complete a program. So if they had a way that they can come out and be like, okay, I'm going to sit here for like 6 months. And in the process of sitting there and they accomplish all of those things, then you find a lot of people accomplishing a lot more in life. But a lot of those positions aren't available for people, you know, and that's scary.
So you had this experience, mm-hmm. no job, yeah. no money, no no transportation. Mm-hmm. And do you not also come out of jail with debt to,
yeah.
like financial debt?
Yeah.
You've paid your debt to society, right. presumably by doing your time. Mm-hmm. But tell us about the legal financial obligations people come out with.
All right. So when you go to prison, if you had a crime against people, then you owe a financial debt to that. You owe a financial debt to the legal obligations, your attorney fees, your trial fees, the county clerk. You got to pay the judge, you know. Your charges in itself is a fee in itself. So those things right there is a whole issue within itself. And then you charge like $100 a day to be in the county while you're in prison, while you're in the county. So they're charging you and then taxing you at the same time. And so when you're released from that, it becomes crucial to try to sustain and grow from that, you know. So that's crucial. If they can cut that part off, a lot of people will be more successful, because if you have to pay, because now some of those they come with warrants. If
they,
you don't pay those
your
off,
wages?
Yeah, they garnish your wages, and on top of that, some people got child support that they got to attend to on top of the LFOs, and now they got classes that they got to take when they get out, anger management classes. They still got
to
take chemical dependency classes, and they got
to
pay for that, you know. And so these things rack up so fast to the point to where it's crucial, you know. So it's hard to litigate from that perspective of everything, you know. So that's one of the most crucial components to me with the LFOs.
So tell us what Numbers to Names does to help mitigate those roadblocks mm-hmm. to success.
So one of the most amazing parts about Numbers to Names to me is that me being a formerly incarcerated person, I get out. I have to take myself serious. And if anybody been incarcerated, this is one key thing I ask them to listen to. You have to take yourself serious.
What do you mean by that?
You got to know what you really want out of life. I know what I want. I want to be a speaker. That's my overall perspective, is to be a motivational speaker on these type of situations, right? And so being that I'm identified with what I want to do, there's nothing that a person can do to encourage me to jeopardize my freedom or jeopardize my opportunity. Secondly, you got to connect yourself with people that are in the field or in the arena to help you better yourself when it comes to education. You got to seek education. If you're not familiar with education, just sit with a group of people that can help you with the educational components. If you're looking for work, you go to the trades. They got forklifting. You know, you can take a program for forklifting. So I know what I want to do. I know exactly what I want to do. And so like Bendo, shout out to my homeboy Bendo, Ben Feldbusch. Ben said it's one thing to be released from prison and to focus on the barriers and the walls you got to go through. But it's another thing to find the endurance to fight through the struggles in order to accomplish that goal that you want to do. And so Numbers to Name is a situation to where me as a storyteller, so I tell my story. I tell my story of stability, making it happen the best way I possibly can without recidivism.
It's a horrible word.
It is a horrible word. And I take advantage of the resources that I do have around me. I don't ignore the resources, regardless how corny it may seem. I take those opportunities serious. I change my circle of people. Though I'm still connected to my community has to understand one thing, that everything that I do outside my circle in the community is to better myself and provide a better opportunity. There's a lot of brothers and sisters that's been released from prison that has degrees, that got companies and got businesses. And I encourage a lot of them to step up to the plate and tell their testimonies of what they've done to become more successful from being released from prison.
So let's say I'm getting out of prison today.
Mm-hmm.
Who do I go to? Where do I go to get in touch with Numbers to Names? How am I going to find you, and what's the first thing you're going to give me?
Okay, so one of the biggest things that I know that works, The people that I work with right now, like you got Karen Dhaliwal, Chris mm-hmm. Hansen, CPTS. You know,
what's CPTS?
Community Transition. Yeah, Community Partnership Transition Solutions. So those, that arena, that circle, they know a lot of people that's being released from prison. So I'm in a position to where I can know who's finna be released. Progress House, to be able to go to the Progress House. Now, my focus is to go to Progress House and drop off pamphlets and let people know that this is somebody that you could contact and connect with us when you get out. The only difference about us with Numbers to Name is that you got to be willing to make a difference and a change for yourself. If you're not willing to do that, then it's not much of a person anybody can do for you. I don't care how many doors is out here swung open for you. If you're not willing to walk through that door and comply, if you're not willing to walk out of that building and walk up to the people that can really help you and allow them to help you, then it's nothing going to come out. And I advise people to stand away from people if you're not going to take them serious, because you can easily make somebody that's a program or organization look bad by not taking advantage of the situation.
I'm going to bring Karen Dhaliwal yes. into the conversation. Karen, you're one of the co-founders of Numbers to Names, are you not?
Yes. Hello, everyone. My name is Karen Dhaliwal, and my day job would be being an apprenticeship navigator at Bates Technical College. And the community advocacy part is being a community advocate for Numbers to Names. That's our group that I'm here with, Threat Brown.
Do you guys have an office, a formal location, someplace that people can come when they get out of jail and they're looking for the resources you have to offer?
So let me explain. Numbers to Names is definitely, it's a group of advocates, but however, we are storytellers and we have access to resources. Even though we may not be the resource, we have access to resources that can help you empower yourself to becoming successful. And so as Threat mentioned, our group CPTS. CPTS is a hub in Pierce County where a lot of organizations who are that work with reentry, people transitioning out of prison, we all get together once a month, and it's a hub for people to come and get those resources, like for housing, for food, for shelter, what rental assistance is out there, what interview access if you need employment. We have all these advocates that are working in the community at Goodwill Outreach, at the workforce, at different colleges, you know, that can help you with your success.
I heard Threat talking about the positive potential of an advocate or a sponsor. Do you envision that ever happening, that people would become sponsors for folks as they come out of jail to help with reentry?
Oh, man, that would be an amazing opportunity for people. That would be an amazing opportunity for companies, these major corporations, these enterprises. That's a good tax write-off if they really look at the fundamentals of what they can do to benefit somebody and really help somebody out.
Prisoners also become, for training employees, yeah, potential employees.
Yeah, because that becomes some of the most hardest working people that you can really find when you find the ones that really want to do something, you know? Because if they know, and again, the reason why a lot of them don't want to do work is because they don't feel like they're able to do the jobs that they fit for or the things that they want to do, you know?
Because they're not trained.
Right, and it's time consuming. And so they're trying to figure out, so how do I even stay paid and go to school and educate themselves? So school is another place where I meet a lot of my people. So I advise somebody to have a meeting with me at school. TCC, go Titans, you know? I say, meet me at TCC or you can meet me at Bates, you know? And so those are some of the environments that we can, us a few of my friends right now that I'm brought to Bates with Karen Dhaliwal, and then I walk them through the process of getting themselves situated for apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship programs to get a better job. With extreme crimes, you know, so it's the opportunities is through the roof nowadays. There's more opportunities in there than there was before.
We have only 2 minutes left. I'm shocked, but I do want to bring another voice into the conversation because, well, Threat, I'd like you to tell us who this person is.
Okay, so you got Big Doze. Doze is my son. You're gonna have to probably come over here. Doze is my son. Our relationship is in the process of building right now. He's an amazing young man. He go to a lot of my programs right now, POU, when we speak to families and other kids about things that's important to them.
So, Dozer, what do you say to other people about your dad?
Well, I say that he's a good person.
You got to get in the mic.
I say that he's a good person and that he works hard and he's trying to rebuild a relationship with me and how he's helping me with what's going on.
And how do you feel that's going?
It's going really good.
I think the fact that you're here is a sign of that. It's really nice to have you, Dozer. I want to thank all three of you for joining us, and I want to thank you listeners for joining us at lunchtime on Tuesday. This is Real Talk, and we're here every Tuesday. We're ready to answer questions, big and small. If you've got one, send it to me at realtalk@voiceofvashon.org. Thanks for listening.